Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is VSiN sports radio host, Gil Alexander. Gil, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you guys for having me. Appreciate it.
So, first of all, what is VSiN for our people who don't know?
It's the Vegas Stats and Information Network. It's on Sirius XM Channel 204. It is started by the Musburger family, Brent Musburger being obviously the most famous of that family. In his quote-unquote retirement from ESPN, his nephew Brian convinced him to be on board for the idea for the first ever satellite radio sports betting station network.
And how did you come to be a part of it?
I did a podcast, and still do a podcast, but did a podcast for many years. And Chrissy Andrews, who's the director of the South Point Hotel Casino Sportsbook, was a regular weekly guest during the NFL season. And we would do, Chrissy's great, by the way, we would do a guessing line show, sort of a tribute to the old Stardust show, guessing lines in the NFL, first reaction to the lines. And Chris would have a story time, and he's got a book coming out based on all those. But one day, a couple seasons ago, he sort of mentioned something was going on. They couldn't really tell me yet, but just be aware that you might be hearing something. I'll let you know. And then I think it was 2016, where he said to me one day, he's like, "Hey, you don't mind if Brian Musburger sits in and listens?" And I was like, "What?" So, no, I didn't mind. I didn't really have a choice in the matter.
You knew recognize the last name.
Did you know who
Brian was?
I did not. I just recognized the last name. And he explained to me afterwards what was going on. And from that came the VSiN job. And I have to tell you, even a couple months later, it was January of 2017, they took me behind this sort of cardboard wall at the South Point and said, "Well, there's going to be a studio here at the Super Bowl. I hope you'll join us." And I was like, in 3 weeks? Like, there's no way. And yet, there it was. It appeared. So the rest is history, as they say.
And your podcast is called?
Podcast is called Beating the Book. So I do that sort of on the side with the VSiN show, which is called A Numbers Game.
And you're on 5 days a week?
Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 Pacific, 10 to noon Eastern.
How do you find the time to do that and still bet?
It's a great question. The manner of my betting has by necessity had to change. I used to be a baseball bettor who used predictive modeling and did nothing but pre-flop baseball bets, what I like to call pre-flop baseball bets, before the game started. I don't bet the same way that I used to. And I think with any good bettor that I know, it sort of has evolved over time. And for me, what worked then doesn't necessarily work now, and I find myself betting, not exclusively, but in different ways, in-game betting, derivative bets, and it doesn't require the same exact kind of preparation that I once had before. Most of my time is preparing for the show the next day, getting guests, that sort of thing. But the betting still exists.
I have a hard time getting guests for a weekly show. Yeah. I can't imagine a five-day...
It's the single biggest challenge that I have. Listen, you can get guests. You just want it to be interesting, though,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
We can all get guests. But for me, 10 hours a week of programming to make it interesting, to make it entertaining, that's a challenge for sure.
And you have more helpers helping you get guests than Richard. Richard has me, well,
still, five times yeah. more, I mean...
It's quite a bit.
That's a lot.
My guests are pretty much my guys, you know, like I'm not really relying on anybody else. You know, I've some shows at VSiN, and this is not to say that my show is, it's just a difference. I really want mine to be sports betting. I don't like it to stray too much into sports radio. Now, there are times of year, let's be honest, July, June, the dead of summer when the content sort of dissipates a little, where there'll be segments where you'll stray into some standard sports radio kind of stuff. But it was never my aspiration to be a sports radio guy where I'm talking about, you know, the fifth starter on the Oakland A's or something like that.
Our guest last week was Bill Krakenberger. He mentioned you recently had a show where you talked about family and disasters that had happened to him and how you're survivors.
Yeah, Bill is wonderful. Bill He's with me my second hour on Thursdays, and it started as a pro football season only thing. Warren Sharp and I would just do a roundtable on that upcoming week's games, a look back on the last week's games. But Bill has enjoyed himself to the point where now he stays with me beyond football season, and our conversations really do sort of get beyond sports betting now. And so, yeah, we did stray into it. We never plan them. We never talk in advance. And this one did stray into, he had a moment in New England when he was at one of his, I think New England or New Jersey, might have been New Jersey, where he was at some of his ancestors, one of his ancestors' houses, and he just got to thinking, and then I related sadly, a Holocaust story. And so, yeah, it got pretty deep. But people, you know, what I think I have learned is that after a couple years of doing this, that people allow me, listeners allow me to do that now. I don't think I could have gotten away with that month one, for instance. But now it's become personal enough where folks respond to it favorably, I hope.
You mentioned that in-game betting, and particularly baseball, is one of your specialties. In-game betting has a lot of disadvantages, where every bet has to be approved, and sometimes the bet isn't approved or disapproved until after you know the result of the bet. And there's always the thought, well, if I make a winning bet, they'll reject it, and if I make a losing bet, they'll accept it. How do you protect yourself against that? How does the industry need to improve?
Well, I assume you're referring to legal Nevada wagering when you're saying that. When okay. It comes to, yeah. Well, this is how I take that is the trouble with the timing or let's say the allegation that the game may have gone on and the timing. That's more of a brick and mortar problem to me. I hope we can be honest on your podcast and say, I make bets offshore. And it's not quite the same issue there. It is a speed game. Sometimes the bets are not approved, but then you just simply try to get it the next moment. But you're able to, in a much easier way, monitor what's happening. It's not foolproof. I don't mean to indicate that it is, but it's not quite the same thing as, and I know Bill, for instance, has had this allegation in the past where he felt like one company here in town was definitely only putting out lines on a delay, approving and rejecting, as you say. What I do in-game in baseball is extremely mechanical, and it's almost without handicap. It is with handicap, but because it has to do with certain characteristics of the baseball game at that moment. But it is not nearly the sort of assessments I used to make of starting pitchers, say, before a game. Oh, here's their fielding independent pitching. Here's their BABIP. Here is where their skill set does not match their conventional stats. This is a way more mechanical thing. And by the way, getting back to our point about the show before and what, you know, what the content, if I want to make the content interesting on my satellite radio show, if I were to get into that on the show, I think when you do any show, and I'm sure you guys strive for this here too as well, you want it to be interesting, you want it to be smart. At the same time, you want it to be entertaining. And so if I went into what I do in those baseball games, it is so boring. Yeah. I cannot even express to you. So it would make the worst radio ever. But it is a very mechanical issue, and I don't worry about what you were talking about there the way I do it.
Okay.
So the delays are not as long, or like Bill mentioned that he only bets during commercials, or
yes,
you know,
that is what I'm doing as well.
Now, also, there have been a number of people arrested for at tennis matches because of the delay in them texting when points happen and people taking advantage of that kind of thing. And I'm wondering about the industry and how they, you know, I'm not sure why they've built this 10-second delay into.
Right.
Into the games, you know what I mean? And
it is problematic. I was, I don't know, I was putting in a pick for a contest during football season at stations for their last man standing contest. And some guy ran up to me when I was just about to do it. He goes, hey, man, can I put in my in-game right here? I got to put it in right here. You know, I had a $100 bill. And I was like, you know, we can relate. I was like, sure. Oops, I'm sorry. Sure, go ahead. Go ahead and do it, sir. You know, but it occurred to me at that moment, because I don't bet in-game at actual brick and mortar casinos and sports books. And I thought to myself, I go, this is really unsustainable. Like, to your point, just the notion of doing that while a game is happening is fraught with turmoil, right? Like, so he might not get it in. He might then complain that it wasn't taken properly. Oh, it already happened, so therefore you're not taking, whatever the case may be. Mine offshore are during breaks. They are not play by play. I'm not necessarily, you know, have I made a bet once in a blue moon? Will the next guy hit a single or a double? Yes, but that's not what my bread and butter is. Mine is in between half innings, making assessments of the lines that they deal then.
And a lot of that, I would think, could almost be automated.
Maybe, although there's a little more to it than that. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some programmer out there could figure out a way to figure out how to do it. But
or some bets. There are some bets that I think you could say, given this situation at this score.
Correct.
You know, just make this bet.
And the beauty of baseball is that it's to me anyway, is way more mechanical in that sense, right? Like, I always sort of chuckle inside when in a football game, you know, you'll see some folks tweet out, well, the win probability for the Saints right here in this situation is 87%. And I always think to myself, and I could be completely wrong about it, because I'm sure it's just all based on data sets anyway, historical data. I always think baseball is so much more reliable in that sense. The meter of the game, the situation, the outs remaining, the score, who's on, you know, all of that. Whereas I think football, oh, it's first and 10 at my own 13. And there's so many more variables that can pollute it to me.
Well, and so much less data to go back to, just because of the sheer number of baseball games
per year. That's right. With 162 games per team multiplied by the number of years, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the rules of baseball, for the most part, have stayed fairly consistent over the years, whereas in football, number of passing yards from 10 years ago is not a good estimate of the number of passing yards today.
Right. The rules have changed so much. Well, they're trying to change them in baseball apparently now. We'll see.
Well, yeah. Also, I think baseball really lends itself to analyzing data because it's much less a team sport than a group of individual players.
Disguised as a team sport.
Right.
That's
right.
Exactly right. Yeah. I've said that for many years. It's an individual sport disguised as a team sport. Every play starts with one guy throwing a ball to another and the rest ensues. I do think that it does lend itself to predictive modeling. And the other portion of that with baseball is that statistics in baseball from the Bill James abstract days have always been public domain. Whereas in other sports, a lot of the advanced stats are kind of proprietary in nature. Soccer, notoriously, is like, we would just want to keep this to ourselves. Whereas baseball, it's just out there for everybody to do with, you know, what they will.
So do you have a stats background? Is that how you got
into
this?
I do not. I mean, I took math classes in college, and I was drawn to math. But unlike, say, a Dr. Bob Stoll, for instance, who is a stats major at California, at University of California, who has that, you know, precise of a stats background, I don't. I was a guy who was the kid in school who started his betting pool. His parents had nothing to do with gambling. It was just somehow wired in me. I felt nothing was wrong about doing that. I did fear that my private school teachers would catch me. And 2-3 years into it, they did. And I'll never forget the teacher who grabbed me by the arm and said, "What are you doing over there?" And I told him, and he goes, "How do I get in on it?" And it was kind of that confluence where I was like, oh, well, this is interesting, right? You don't really process it that way, but you're like, oh, so this has some universal appeal beyond what I'm doing. From there, I got most of my, you know, I was a big sports fan. I collected baseball cards. I was obsessed with the prices of baseball cards in the Beckett Price Guide, and sort of got my sports betting education in the 90s from Pinnacle used to put out a newsletter, and it was authored, the name that was used was Simon Noble. I don't know if that was a real person or not. It might have been a pseudonym. Elihu Foistel, I don't know if you guys know who that is. Very successful bettor, and I think he works, I'm not sure about this, don't hold me to that, but I think he might work for some offshore books. But he claimed once to me that he was the writer of some of these. Whatever the case, they were brilliant. And they were very gambler friendly in the sense that they taught you about what is the definition of a sharp better, what is a positive EV bet. And so that's how those worlds sort of collide. And then Moneyball sort of lit a light bulb for me as well and said, oh, these principles that they're using here to exploit the inefficiencies of the player personnel market in baseball. And all I kept hearing to myself was betting on sports. So throw all of that into the wash.
So did you teach yourself to program? Or did you hire someone to do the modeling?
Yeah, my stuff was very simple on Excel. And then when I needed to go beyond that, I would bring somebody to help me. Yeah.
And do you bet other sports too?
Or yeah, I do bet other sports. But it's funny when you say with the show, some of the things that I do here is it's very deliberate. So, I do something on my show called Tankapalooza, which was sort of a nod, not sort of a nod, but an actual nod. It didn't really work out so well this year because the NBA changed its rules towards the NBA draft. But last year, it was just this amazing 2-month run of simply betting against teams who were putting out lineups on the basketball court deliberately designed not to win basketball games. Now, the players on the court weren't showing poor effort, but the coaches were sort of manipulating it so they wouldn't. And this was a real thing for 2 months. And so it's little gimmicky things like that that have sort of infiltrated what I do now. And most folks would listen and say, that's the squarest thing I've ever heard. But one of the things that I think that I've been sort of perched in a good spot to sort of figure out over the years is, because all the people who have generously come on the shows, is that sports betting is this spectrum, and there's the most mathematical-oriented handicapper on one end of that spectrum, and then there's the most smoke and mirrors, whatever the heck, guy on the other. And I think what I've learned is that oftentimes the correct answer is somewhere in the middle, and anybody who's too arrogant about their approach ought to be a little more humble that theirs is not the only way that works.
Well, and also what works today isn't necessarily going to work six months from now.
And it will not work 6 months from now. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the odds that the New Orleans Saints were going to win was some such number. The New Orleans Saints coach was behind one of the biggest rule changes in the offseason. Sean Payton, they got... case could be made that they got robbed last year, so they got the rules changed. Do you have any strong opinion as to being allowed to challenge anything is going to help the game, hurt the game? Is there any advantage to bettors on this?
I don't think there's an advantage to bettors that I can think of off the top of my head. I could be very wrong about that. My initial reaction to that stuff, and I do believe the New Orleans Saints got the rules changed, I don't think there's much controversy about that, is that, we've seen this in the CFL, the Canadian Football League. They are able to challenge PIs. I just fear that we are ill-equipped to deal with it and that everything is going to be challenged in a way that stagnates the game far beyond what it already is and is bothersome already to many people who watch football. That's my biggest fear. My biggest fear is, oh God, what have we done here? What we wish for is often not what we ultimately are going to be happy with. And so I do worry that that's what's going to happen. I don't know that I can think of that specifically has an advantage to bettors other than, well, maybe you won't get hosed as much, but
All right. You work for VSiN. Sometimes the guests on their programs would be called touts, meaning you pay me so much money and I'll tell you who's going to win Monday night's game. Generally, touts do not have a good reputation. Do you ever have touts on your show? Do you have a feeling that that bad reputation is well deserved, or how does this all work?
I think the pick-selling industry in general is obviously something that has been smeared for, not smeared, but is rightfully railed against because of its history. It's just been awful. I always start this conversation by saying, okay, let's define the word tout. The word tout means, by literal definition, aggressive marketing. And so that conjures up an image of a Vegas Dave, of these guys screaming on TV and that sort of thing. And obviously there's been different layers, different levels of that through the years. What I have on my show in terms of pick sellers is I have someone like a Dr. Bob. Now, I agree with you that most pick sellers are long-term losers. But I also don't believe in defining everyone with the same brush stroke. And so I think, you know, I related this on the air. Me and Crack actually had this conversation on the air the other day. And I related it to, however politically incorrect this is, to the Me Too movement. And one of the things that I said is the Me Too movement is a wonderful thing that has happened in our society. It needed to happen. Men got away with horribly misogynistic things for far too long. However, like with anything in life, and I'm just using Me Too as an example, like with any movement in life, there is a section of that Me Too movement that is okay with bringing down a couple innocents for the greater cause. And I'm not okay with that in anything. So for me, when people immediately say, oh, touts, they're horrible human beings, I just don't believe in calling Vegas Dave the same thing as a guy like a Dr. Bob. So when I have Bob on, I'm very comfortable with it because people can hear him. He's not, first of all, he's not selling anything. If you believe by his sheer presence that that's promoting him, well, okay, then guilty as charged. But we are never, and by the way, in my podcast for years and years, there's never an active promotion of anything. In the case of Bob on A Numbers Game, people can hear his methods. They can hear how smart he is. And with anything, it's, hey, here's how I lean, here's how I pick, and everyone's free to do what they want to at that point. But there's, you know, that's my only objection to that. But I would absolutely agree with the premise. I mean, good Lord, if you watch the Showtime action docuseries, you see the worst example of that.
Tell us what you really think about Vegas.
Well, I don't think I have to. I think the docuseries does the job. I mean, here's the thing. A lot of sports bettors, when they heard that Vegas Dave was going to be on this series, they immediately sort of said, I'm not watching this. He's on it. Forget this. They already suck. That's my imitation of people on Twitter, by the way. But what I urge them to do is, well, why don't you watch it, right? Like, why don't you watch it and let him, and then judge. And if you don't like it after that, if you think they've done a you know, poorly, then voice your concerns. I think anybody who watches this objectively can't help but come to the conclusion that something's wrong with him, like beyond the fact that he's the worst of the worst pick sellers. His parents, who appear on the show, are objectively the sweetest people in the world. And you can tell that they know, and they even admit they've bailed out their son for to the tune of $750,000 over time. And these are people who make $40,000 a year, something like that.
He took their whole life savings.
Yeah, you can tell that they don't want to delve. The father even said, I don't want to Google, I don't want to know. And, you know, we're three series in at the time that we're recording this podcast. I think anybody objectively watching realizes that he's pretty much hung himself. And I will say this conversely, you can have the opinion, you're absolutely entitled to have the opinion that, well, yeah, but just by his presence, there's going to be somebody out there that's going to, just because they see his lifestyle and they're going to go after this, you know, this notion of this dream that he's projecting. Well, that might be right, but I would sort of suggest those are the people you can't help anyway.
Well, except I think people who only see the first episode are going to look at him and go, wow, this guy, you know, this guy makes money. I mean, this is...
That's fair. Crack and I talked about that. They probably cut off that episode in the name of cliffhanger is, you know, whatever they were going for. Yeah, that was an unfortunate cutoff. I'll give you that.
Right.
Yeah.
So I've been pleasantly surprised with the show. You know, whenever you hear there's going to be a gambling show, I just automatically assume it's going to suck.
Right.
And as I say, I've been pleasantly surprised. I've thought the show has been really, really pretty good.
Yeah. You know, look, these are guys who are award-winning at what they do. They had 4 months. I mean, like, part of this is, and this is, you sort of have to, in my attempt to be a liaison between the gambling community and the real world kind of thing, right? You put on that hat and you're like, these are Showtime people who had 4 months to put on a show about sports betting. They know nothing about sports betting. Now, I always say, I go, imagine if somebody came to me and said, hey, Gil, could you do a documentary on opera? You got 4 months. Go. I would be like, what in the world am I going to do? And what you would do is you would sort of ask somebody who you trust, all right, introduce me to as many people as possible. They, for the 4 months that they had to do it, I think it's a outstanding job.
Yeah, and if you compare it to any of the gambling shows 60 Minutes has done.
Oh, is that the worst, the last one?
Well, they all have been.
Yeah.
You know.
The Billy Walters interview?
The what?
No.
The Billy Walters interview?
No, I wouldn't call that really a gambling show. Yeah. I mean, that was a show about Billy Walters.
The latest one aired simultaneously, concurrently with the first episode of Action, and it was... It got mired once again into an athletic director at Marshall, who, by the way, was at UNLV. I can't believe he didn't know any better. You would think he'd be more evolved. But he was just saying, I don't know, these kids are going to get corrupted. It was like half of it was about, you know, that sort of theme.
But they, as I say, they all have been.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We are talking with Gil Alexander. We're going to take a brief commercial break to hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In April, the promotion is free buffets. On Mondays through Thursdays, earn 300 points before 1 p.m. and get a free lunch buffet. If you do that and also earn an additional 300 points prior to 8 p.m., you get a free dinner buffet. If you do not earn the 300 points prior to 1 p.m., but still earn 600 points prior to 8 p.m., you earn the dinner buffet that day. To get the vouchers for these buffets, you go to the kiosk. They do not have to be used on the same day earned, but they all expire on Thursday, May 2nd. Also, if you have enough vouchers, you may treat several others in addition to yourself. If you have provided the South Point with your email address, you will receive free play bonuses every weekend in April. The size of your bonus depends on how big of a player you are. It's too late to get the bonus for this month if you have not already done so. But they do this promotion two or three times a year. So if you live close to South Point, it's worth providing your email address. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Stack the Deck. This is a 7 coins per line game where on the dealt hands, trips, quads, full houses, and 4 of the royal, you receive from 3 to 5 extra cards of the exact card to make up your hand. That is, if you're dealt 3-3-3-6-6, and instead of having 1-3 to make the 4 threes, if you draw to it, now you're going to be giving 3 additional threes, and you'll have 6 threes out of 52 cards, giving you plenty of chances to get quads, quints, that is 5 of kinds, and quads with a kicker. They have an extra pay schedule categories of a baby royal, which means 9 through the king, and 5 of a kind. Since the game is fixed at 7 coins per line, sometimes they have to change the pay schedules to make the game within acceptable bounds, meaning loose enough for players to be interested in playing and tight enough for the casinos to offer. So a 9-6-4 double-double bonus becomes 10-7-5, meaning you get more for the flush and more for the straight. These will require a considerable number of strategy changes to play appropriately. Okay, we're talking to Gil Alexander. In Vegas and elsewhere, William Hill has a lot of outlets, and they're not known to allowing players with a pulse to play there. Now, you're a podcast host, so that gives you a certain amount of celebrityhood. Does that make it more likely to be allowed to bet by William Hill or less or what?
Last year on VSiN, on my VSiN satellite radio show on a numbers game, I documented. In fact, if you go to my Twitter at Beating the Book, it's the pinned tweet. I did bet NFL draft props at William Hill, at the Hooters William Hill spot. And... that led to a sort of 17-minute expose on what happened to me when I bet those. I did very well on NFL draft props, as many people did. My subset, I think it was, I was 9-1-1 total, but my subset at William Hill was 6-0. And when I went there to cash, and I won't rehash the whole story, but essentially they paid me on three and then gave me a lot of guff about the other three. And what ensued was a sort of back and forth on site that then went up the William Hill chain all the way to Nick Bogdanovich, and then later, and this part wasn't told on the air, later to Joe Asher, who was making sort of threats above me, saying that Gil better not do this segment. But to VEASAN's credit, they backed me, and I did the entire segment and sort of laid it out there.
Wait, what was their excuse for not wanting to pay the other three?
Well, yeah, without going into the whole story, because it'll last forever, but essentially, they were, the first excuse was, oh, that's not what that prop meant. It was a Baker Mayfield. Who will get drafted first, Baker Mayfield or Lamar Jackson? Baker Mayfield was the bet. He ended up getting picked first, Lamar Jackson 32nd, but they put in these weird spreads. And I can't remember now at the time, I lay it out again. It's pinned up there for everybody to listen to. It was +7.5 or -7.5, but whatever. They were acting. The first person said, oh, 1 + 7.5 = 8. 32 is greater than 8. I'm like, are you guys, you know, my first reaction was, are you guys kidding me? Like, is this some kind of bizarro word problem you've given us?
Fool's
day. Yeah. That was the first thing. And by the way, I was less polite than that. I was like, are you guys, you can imagine. And then it turned into, well, no, the plus meant this minus. And then I proved on air. I said, nope, that's not what you said. Here's what you said. If it was just me you're talking to, everybody agree with it. Went on and on about, there were three different props. And sure enough, three didn't go through. And I got kicked up to sort of middle management of William Hill. They tried cutting me a deal. Oh, we'll refund your money. I was like, that's very polite of you, but no, that's not good.
Stick it where the sun don't shine.
That's right. And what ended up happening is, Monday I talked to Nick Bogdanovich. The people who were in the middle management were very polite. When it got to Nick, he wasn't so polite. He was a little annoyed because I represented an annoyance to him at that point. And Nick hates these NFL draft props. But essentially, he said, well, let me talk to, you know, my bosses or whatever, and I'll get back to you. We'll call you back. And I can't remember the circumstances. Again, it's all detailed. This is over a year ago. But essentially what I did is I came into work. I told some folks who knew him, I was like, hey, make this happen so that I don't have to do this on the air. I don't want to do this on the air. I want this to go away. But they wouldn't cooperate. And Monday, I waited to see if they would do the right thing. They didn't. When they didn't on Tuesday, I told my bosses at VEASAN, I'm doing this Wednesday morning. And I did it. And right as I got off the air for that segment, right as I clicked off, right as the mic was clicked off, my phone, Nick Bogdanovich. And he said, tell everybody to call this number. Because what occurred to me is, when I went in on Monday, I got paid. So they took care of me. But it occurred to me when I got paid, oh, are they just paying me to shut me up because I host a radio show? Or are they paying everybody? And so I thought to ask him that, and what I found out is they were just paying me. And so I felt a responsibility that everybody who had these draft props get paid. And so that's when they didn't do right on that Monday or Tuesday. When I went on the air Wednesday, subsequently everybody then ended up getting paid. So in that respect, I was very gratified that I had that impact on that. But to answer your initial question now, I don't bet at William Hill very often. In fact, I would say I've met...
Wait, you mean you still can?
Yes. So wow. I've made probably less than 15 bets at William Hill, and they are all when they make a terrible mistake. So the NFL draft props represented terrible mistakes, in my opinion, and they manifested that way as well by winning them all. They put out a couple Cleveland Browns props before CG. CG was the first one to put out, yes, season win totals, where they put out a Cleveland Browns over 8.5 wins, -120. They won't make the playoffs, no, +155. And so I went in there because as soon as I heard that, I'm like, that's ridiculous. Who's making these lines? That's free money. The only way I can get beaten is if they go 8-8, win their division, and make the playoffs. So I ran in there. I said, look, I only want a dime on each of these. If you can't only do one, I don't want it. And I sit there in those moments. I only want both of them. and see if it goes through, and it does go through. The other day, they had a stray 50-1 on Cody Bellinger, for instance, to win the home run title, whereas other folks in town had gone down to 20-1, 12-1, or whatever. And this was right before a series at Coors. I ran in there. A buddy of mine tipped me off, actually. I ran in there with, and I was like, he was like, oh, they're not going to take more than a few hundred bucks. And I said, let's try a dime. Went in there, put a dime, and it went through. So I'm very, every time Cody Bellinger steps to the plate, it's a big deal for me this summer. The point of that is that, and Ron Flatter, one of my coworkers at VSiN, just wrote a piece at VSiN.com about being able to bet on one of the prospective Kentucky Derby favorites, one of the top six or seven horses, and he got that horse at 90-1 on some glitch that wasn't supposed to be, but it went through, and he actually spoke to Nick, and Nick said, we'll honor it. I believe, I can't prove this, but I believe that that NFL draft segment embarrassed them enough that I'm the last person in the world that they would ban at this point. I really do believe that. First of all, I don't bet there often, right? I make.
But I'm also surprised because there's kind of a long history of them saying, oh, this is a mistake bet and we're not going to honor it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
but you're getting away with these.
So. Well, here's the thing. They're not doing that anymore. With me, they're not doing it. And I don't say that with any, you know, bravado or any chest flexing. I really do believe, because I know how far up the chain it went. I know they're aware of that segment. I know that it had an impact on them. Here's the other thing, and I know, have you guys met Ed Miller? Have you had him on the show?
Yeah, he's been a frequent guest.
So I don't know Ed, but Ed once said something about William Hill that I completely resonated with me, which is we all live in the sports betting world, and we know that sports bettors tend to be, I don't know, equal parts arrogant. They want to let you know how smart they are all the time. So I think there's a lot of people who say, oh, I've been banned by William Hill. Well, yeah, if you try to get banned, you're going to get banned. So the other thing that I don't do is press the issue. So I'm not going in there with 10 dimes, right? I'm not, here's one, here's another, here's another. Yeah, I'm going to get banned if I do that. I like the ability to be kind enough to, when I do see something that's messed up in their lines, to go in there and say, all right, here's a dime, here's two dimes, whatever it is that they'll take. And Ed said the same thing. Ed's like, yeah, I'm not banned either because I don't try to be banned. And so I think, I mean, if we're to be honest about it, part of that is a lot of people, like, you know, and other people say they're banned for other reasons. It's not even about their bets, right? People sort of conflate the two, like, oh, I'm banned. Let me act like it's because I bet so successfully. So I think there is an art to that as well, right?
Well, also, you're going in and betting at the counter where they may not know who you are. If you were trying to do it on the app.
They take my ID.
Oh, yeah. For a dime? Really?
Yeah, they do.
Huh.
They do.
Yeah.
They're well aware.
On the app?
No, at the counter.
But you, would they take a diamond on app?
Haven't tried.
Bring our audience.
Actually, that's kind of surprising, too, just because it's so much more convenient to bet on the apps.
Yeah. I use the app to check the lines, but I'm not, I do, yeah, that they can track you that much more easily that
yes.
way, right?
Yeah.
So.
Now, I'm not totally up to date on the Nevada laws. Let's assume that you are a super smart bettor and I know nothing about betting sports, which is basically correct. Now, if I take your bets and go up to William Hill and they look up and my name is clean in sports betting, are we breaking laws? How does this work?
I believe you are not allowed to have, I mean, by law, there's a runner law, right? So I don't think
messenger betting.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that technically. Now, I'm not sure how vigilant the enforcement of that is.
Also, my understanding is that if you have a financial stake in the bet, then it is okay. It's not messenger betting. It's only if you are simply a runner and you have no stake in the bet. But Vegas has gotten so bad about how much they'll let you bet that the days of Billy Walters and people like that getting down hundreds of thousands of dollars in Las Vegas just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't know that I haven't heard of anyone being pulled up for messenger betting in years and years and years.
No.
Maybe it's happening, but
yeah.
I haven't heard about it.
And it seems so easy to get around, even that if Gil put up 100,000 and I put up 100
right.
into yeah. the pool, then yes, I'm a part of this, even though wouldn't be much of a part.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know. Like, I'm trying to think. If I went up to a counter and I say, "Oh, here, can I? This 1,000 is for me, and 1,000 is for my buddy." Like, I don't even know if they'd stop me. I don't know. You know.
Yeah. Right.
Even
yeah.
though technically yeah. I'm not supposed
yeah,
to
like,
do
could
that.
Could you print 2 tickets?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How is the sports media today different than the sports media of, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
I assume you mean as it relates to betting primarily.
Sure.
Sure. Let's go with that. Well, I mean that's the
big... It works for him, it yeah. works for me.
Well, it's so different in so many ways, but because we deal in sports betting, I mean, this is the big thing, right? With legalization, and I was sort of, I guess honored is the right word, to be on air at VSiN the moment the Supreme Court, because my show happens to be at 7 a.m. Pacific, 10 a.m. Eastern, which is when the Supreme Court gets their boxes and has their decisions. Oh, there is, you know, I had to prepare for many weeks. I had to prepare for 2 shows, my normal show. And oh, if the Supreme Court decides on this day to, you know, say something about sports betting. So anyway,
one way or the other,
one way
so
or
that
the other,
3 shows.
That's right. One way or the other. And I, you know, you had to navigate the legalese, which is not something that's that easy, but it was awesome. But with legalization of sports betting, you know, the fear is with all the good that some may feel that brings, I'm not so sure it's all good. There's going to be a proliferation of the bad. So you get back to the worst of pick sellers. I mean, good Lord, you can see it on Twitter already, right? Everybody is a prospective expert on picks. The media is an interesting thing. And I think VSiN, you know, look, the Musburgers deserve a lot of credit for starting VSiN sort of ahead of the curve. On the other hand, like, I think those of us who were in sports betting, you know, knew that this was a great idea that was going to happen one way or the other. So they do deserve a lot of credit. Now that that bigger media companies that are public companies in some cases feel more comfortable with discussing sports betting in a much more overt way now that the states are falling on this. The real thing is, okay, how educated on this subject are they going to be? As you guys probably know better than anybody, you kind of live this life, right? It's in your DNA. This consumes you. Like, this is who you are. And it's not like you do this as a hobby. You're that person. This is how you were born, kind of thing. And when somebody else tries to come into something like sports betting and half-asses it, excuse my language, we can sniff out those people very quickly. So I think ESPN was very smart in that they waited a year. I think they had designs on doing a daily show, very quickly. Daily Wager is their daily show on ESPN News, which debuted in March. What ended up happening is I think that the Fox show fell flat in terms of viewership, that ESPN no longer felt the pressure to sort of get there quickly. And so you're seeing, hopefully, the more deliberate ones are well done. And I'm not taking a shot at the Fox show, other than might not have been the greatest time slot for them, might not have been the most carefully crafted together. I don't know. They'd have a better answer than that. I'll tell you this, and this is where I sort of, I think the best answer to the question, sorry to be long-winded, is I had a meeting with one of these big-time LA agents, one of the big agencies. And he already represented a couple clients who were in at big media companies and who delved into sports betting. And he also represented a couple of the Barstool guys who were sort of dealing in sports betting, but dealing at a much more casual entertainment level about it, not trying to be so smart about it. And the upshot of that conversation, and what was so sort of jarring for me, is, you know, you live in this world where you think, oh, if you're the smartest and you're the most intelligent doing this, whoever that may be, you think that there's a sort of meritocracy, like, oh, you'll rise to the, you know, you'll be that guy or whatever it is. And I think in the end, you just have to be yourself no matter who you are. But what I got from him is, and it sort of clicked very quickly, which is, oh, wow, that's not going to matter at all. He is just concerned with who's going to cast the widest net, which is what any TV endeavor or radio endeavor really tries to do ultimately. And so what he said was, he was very, very straightforward in, you know, I don't care if you're the best or if that guy's the best or if that guy's the best. I just want the ones that are going to win. And so for him, it was...
By winning, meaning ratings.
Correct. And so for him, it was the Barstool guys. And, you know, say what you will, they might be wildly entertaining. Not exactly the most sophisticated sports bettors in the world. I think they would probably agree as well. So you do then get the sense very quickly, oh, so that's how it's going to be. And so people who are immersed in sports betting, that's not going to be the answer they necessarily want to hear in some cases. I have to be aware of that on my show every day, though, right? Like, there's a, you know, the dead of baseball season, we got to fill content, let's be honest. And there's going to be some segments where I'm like, okay, now I'm going to read, like, analytics about these starting pitchers. And as I'm saying it, there's a voice in my head that's going, well, you know, this could be, like, super intelligent for Roxy Roxborough, who's listening in Phuket, Thailand, who will say, that's the best segment you've ever done, Gil. But I realize that, like, it's not very entertaining to the masses, right? Like, just to use the most extreme example. And so it's the constant balance of what is smart and what is entertaining and how you achieve that.
And that's so hard.
Yeah.
That is so hard. But the other thing that's been such a massive change is, you know, us. And, you know, you started with a podcast,
yeah,
right? With a microphone and a computer, and
you're lucky if I was wearing pants, Richard.
Right, and yeah, thousands of people now are, no, able to,
I don't
start,
want to think about that.
Are able to start doing this, and they put it on YouTube or they put it out on iTunes or whatever, and some of those people will rise.
Yes,
you know, but yeah, yeah. And I agree. It's a constant struggle trying to keep it entertaining and not a bunch of BS at the same time.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. For me, it's a, I want to establish, excuse me, some baseline of, oh, I get it. He can string a couple sentences together. He knows what he's talking about. I don't want to be the smartest, you know, if you're constantly trying to be the smartest guy in the room, people sense that, right? And people also are oftentimes, most people don't relate to, you know, predictive modeling or advanced analytics. Most people just don't. So if, listen, part of being employed is I want people to listen. And in order to get people to listen, it is an art, you know, more than it is a science. You got to figure it out. And people relate to you, and you just got to be, I think, yourself. And people are smart. They figure it out.
Personally, I'm trying to be the funniest guy in the room.
I laughed.
You'll be invited back. Being a knowledgeable bettor and hosting a regular radio show are very different skill sets. How did you decide you wanted to become a host, and what did you do to prepare yourself for that?
Well, I was the kid who, when I watched my first Redskins game, and I was 6 years old, I could think of nothing else after that. I was just immediately obsessed with sports. And then I, you know, again, nobody telling me, my parents aren't from this country, I started acting like I was a sportscaster at 6, 7 years old, right? Like, something drew me to that. I didn't, you know, it's whatever. It was just in me. And then I went to school, private school. My parents are Jewish and come from a very, one son should be a doctor, the other should be a lawyer. Well, they got their doctor, right? And then so every time I introduce my NASCAR segment, by the way, not every time, but every once in a while when I introduce the NASCAR segment, I will say, my parents' dream was to have a doctor and a guy who talked about cars racing around an oval, you know, from a off-strip casino that caters to cowboys and bowlers. You know, it's a 2 for 2, mom and dad. So that's the funny part where it's like they get their doctor. Oh, my one son's a doctor. The other one's still deciding. Like, they don't really get it, right? And so I was just that guy. And
is he trying to be the funniest guy?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Bob. I'll ratchet it back.
I'll try to get over it.
But so anyway, that was always in me. I went to college. I mean, oh, liberal arts school. It's in U.S. News and World Report. Go to a great school, whatever you can go to. And then someday in college, I think I was sophomore or junior year when I was bouncing from an English major to a psychology major to a political science. How do I get out of here in 4 years? I realized that I knew all along what it is that I wanted to do. And I wanted to do some sort of broadcasting. Problem is that I was gravitating in towards music, and I was a radio DJ in my 20s. And then as I got older and the advent of podcasting happened in the mid-2000s, and I realized I'm probably not going to want to announce a hip-hop record when I'm 45 years old, I was like, oh, here's my sports and my sports betting interest, and here's this new form of broadcasting. Let me see if I can reinvent myself into something that's much more authentic for me, because I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do what I actually do. And so that's how that was born. And, you know, from four listeners, fives of listeners the first time you do it, to thousands and tens of thousands, you realize, oh, this seems to be resonating. And my thing was I started out initially as like, I'm the anti-tout. I saw a vacuum for honest sports betting. Not only do I want to tell you when I win, I'm going to tell you when I lose, and I'm going to be honest about it. And here's sort of where it twists. I ended up being sort of naive, and it's funny because on Twitter everybody thinks they know everything about you. I was sort of naive and seduced by someone who turned out. And by the way, charge me about being naive at a young age. You're 100% right. I wanted to do a podcast. I wanted to do it in sports betting. I wanted to do it a bigger platform. And I realized, oh, when I got into it, I'm like, oh, this person is not who I want to be associated with. So I ended up starting a podcast there. I ended up turning from there, and it all worked out in the end, you know. And so that's how I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster. I love the subject of sports betting. I'm fascinated by every aspect of it. I'm fascinated by the psychology of it. And so it's a subject that I could talk endlessly about, as you can tell.
If someone wanted to follow in your footsteps, how would you recommend they get started?
From the broadcast side or the betting side?
Uh-huh.
If it was my child, he said, uh-huh, just go, Gil, just talk. If it was my child, I would not want, I would, if they ever showed an inclination, I don't have children, but if I had a child who showed an inclination to be a better, I would have long talks with that child, because I think you really, and again, you guys are more expert in this than I am, I think you really have to just be tweaked in a certain way, and that someone who is aspiring to it, who isn't really that person, they shouldn't do this. Like the ability to overcome negative variance, the ability to be rational about your bets, just, it's just such a specific makeup. And the ability to be, you know, to not be so risk averse when appropriate. There's so many things that go into it. And again, I find it endlessly fascinating. So that part, I would have to check. It was my child now. I would have to check it many, many times, I think. The broadcast side of things, and I say this to aspiring podcasters too, because in one respect, I was sort of podcasting way before most were. I started my podcast in earnest in 2010, which is sort of the dark ages of podcasting. And anybody who's sort of started since then who asked me for any advice, I said,
we waited till 2011.
Did you 2011? Yeah. Oh, so you guys know it. But what I say to people, and you guys have a perfect setup here, we're actually doing it face to face in a studio, but I always say to them, I go, there's two things. One, make it sound good, right? Like the technical side of things. You guys have set this up. It sounds good. We're actually talking to each other.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
We have, when we do shows on the telephone.
But like, that's the first thing, right? Because if you don't have that barrier, people are going to tune out immediately. You could be the smartest person in the world, but people are going to tune out. And the other thing is, if you really want to do this, plan on being good at it. Like, do your homework, do your prep, know what you're talking about. So, because people, if you're good, will want you to do more and then will expect you to do more. Don't just do it, you know, half-ass and then, I don't know if I'll put out a podcast today. So, I mean, it's amazing how, now that sounds very logical to us, right? It's amazing how many of these kids are like, whatever.
So, I just have to say, I do have kids.
Yeah.
And I have one son who is a better. He is a, I guess, what you would call a professional gambler. I
mean, one of your sons is better than the other? Is that what you said?
A better. Yeah. But anyway, and I don't think he'll end up there as a profession. But From the beginning, I told them math is where the money is. Learn to program, like, because no matter where you end up in life, that's going to be just a skill that's really invaluable. But as far as the podcasting or the, you know, I have a son who's tremendously into sports, who thinks he should have an ESPN show. And what I tell them is, look, there is no barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Just start shooting on your phone.
Just,
you know,
do it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
And throw it on YouTube, and only one person will watch it, your girlfriend or whatever.
Right.
And your parents, you know, I'll watch it. But by doing it, you will get better at it, and
100%.
And you will learn. You'll learn a lot.
You only get better by reps. It's the old, if you read the Malcolm Gladwell, which one was it? I want to say it was Outliers. The old 10,000-hour rule, and some people have a problem with that rule. But essentially what he's trying to say is, look, the Beatles didn't become the Beatles overnight. They had 10,000 shows in Hamburg, Germany before we ever saw them or whatever it was.
Right.
So you got to do that for sure. But you were encouraging of it, were you?
Yeah.
From the beginning. You weren't concerned at all?
What, gambling?
Yes.
Oh,
for
no,
your
because,
son.
I mean, basically, I made that. That was my living for 40 years or whatever. So
you couldn't say to your child, don't do it.
Yeah, and I didn't have any qualms about it because I think it teaches them so many really, really great life skills.
I think you're right.
About risk and about understanding expected value and just tons of great things come out of it. And as I say, he's doing it. I don't think he'll do it forever. Right now he's, you know, able to make money, but I think he'll end up going into other things. I don't know what yet, but I wish he had learned to program. He didn't do that. So
That's great, though. My girlfriend has children. I don't have children. And one of the things I've learned from her, because my parents were, my mother was in the Mossad. So it explains a lot about my childhood, where if I strayed, I was quickly put back into line. What I've learned from my girlfriend is this, and I think it's such a great progressive way of parenting today, and it's such in contrast to mine. Not that I want to, they're wonderful people, my parents. I don't want to indicate that they're not, but she is super encouraging of her children. And I think what I love that you say that, because if you see your child have some inclination to do something that they're passionate about, by all means, foster that.
Yeah. And, you know, my son played basketball from the time he was in fourth grade. And that's the other thing. I keep telling him, look, you know, you love basketball. They're desperate for coaches for, you know, the kind of basketball he played from fourth grade up. You know, go start coaching. Just, you're not going to make any money, but you'll like it.
Yeah.
Right? You'll have a good time. So, yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. Encourage them to, life is too short to work at stuff that you hate.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Gil Alexander. Thank you very much. This was a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
You just are likely to be invited again. It wouldn't surprise me. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.